Welcome to Still Scared Talking Children's Horror, a podcast about creepy, spooky, and disturbing children's books, films, and TV. I'm Ren Wednesday, my co-host is Adam Wybray, and today we're talking about the manga and associated film of The Drifting Classroom by Kazuo Umezu. A full transcript of this will be available, so check the show notes for that, and enjoy! Hello, Adam.
Hello, Ren. Oi.
Hi.
Hi.
You excited to talk about some wild manga?
I'm excited and a little apprehensive and overwhelmed because The Drifting Classroom is one damn thing after another.
It sure is. So yeah, that's what we're talking about today. The Drifting Classroom by Kazuo Umezu. From 1971 to 4, I think?
Yes, that was the run, yeah.
Yeah, so that's 11 volumes, I think, of just, horror and chaos and apocalypse and, all sorts, really.
there's a lot. There's a lot. Recently republished in collected editions by Viz Media, which I lovingly ordered for Ipswich Library. So if you live in Suffolk, listener, you can get hold of these from the library now.
Nice. How did you come across it then?
That's a really good point. It presented itself to me. Seriously, I don't know. I read it around the time I did my PhD.
Uh-huh.
I think the second year of my PhD I read it. So, God, how many years? Is that like, 7 years back? 8 years back?
Okay.
Maybe 7 years back? Something like that. But I don't even know how. Like, I must have just been like looking up horror manga. I was definitely already into Junji Ito, so I'd read Uzumaki, and I'd probably scoured my way through all the Junji Ito I could find online. So I might have just like looked up best horror manga, basically, and come across it. And I ordered the first volume, and I did actually order them all. I quite respectably, I think, didn't just read all the scanlations online. I did get all of the individual volumes.
Wow.
Yeah. And I quite liked having it staggered, actually, and getting to read it in instalments. You know, it is a serialized manga, and it is a lot to read all at once, as I'm sure you experienced.
Yes, as I can attest. It was a lot to read over the course of a week or so, yeah.
Well, thank you for doing it and indulging me.
Well, no, I mean, I really enjoyed it, but it was quite the journey.
Yeah, so this is basically Lord of the Flies in the future, but more. And the "but more" is capitalised and underlined and embossed and given a shadow.
Yeah, I do have to admit at this point that I've never read Lord of the Flies.
It's all right. I read it. It's good. It's definitely, it's much more misanthropic, I would say, than The Drifting Classroom. So The Drifting Classroom is much more wild, much nastier. But you get the sense that Umezu likes kids and believes in kids. Whereas you don't get that from William Golding. Like, it's a really kind of crotchety. It's a bit of a kind of crotchety man, old man waves fist at cloud book. Like, oh, these kids, oh, if you left those boys to themselves, oh, they're just kiddie, oh, terrible kids these days. Ugh, human nature. Whereas yeah. The interesting thing about the drifting classroom is, as much as Umezu's shaking his fist at mankind for spoiling nature and generally sort of decimating the world, he's definitely pro-kids. He definitely believes that kids, you know, have more about them than adults. We'll get onto this, yeah. But the adults in the drifting classroom do not come out of it as well.
No, they sure don't. So very briefly, it's about a Japanese elementary school which is at the centre of an explosion and is transported into the future, with initially 862 students and faculty who very quickly begin to drop off, but they have to try and survive in this world that's sort of become a barren expanse of sand inhabited by monsters, and face a lot of trials and tribulations. And our main character is called Sho Takamatsu, and we'll kind of introduce the characters as we go, really.
So Sho is a boy of spirit. He's quite steadfast and stubborn. At first, is shown to have mother issues, which is there is a film adaptation which I'm sure we'll discuss sort of after the manga. From 87, I think.
Yeah.
By Obayashi, Nobuhiko Obayashi, who's the same director of Houseu, which, if you've seen any of his films, is the only one you would have seen, basically. It's a bit of a cult classic. The Drifting Classroom film is not a cult classic. even Arrow Video has not put this one out. but we'll get onto it. But what I will say is, Sho's mother issues are doubled down on troublingly in the film. But they're present in the manga. He has a very intense relationship with his mother.
I love you. I love you. Oh, my dear sweet mommy.
Sho!
A real kind of love-hate relationship. And on the day he is... he goes to school and then is blasted into the future. He has a very stormy argument with his mother, in which he says, you know, I wish you weren't my mother. And she says, you know, I wish you weren't my son. And this whole sequence is very fraught. And my stepson, 9-year-old stepson George, finds it hilarious. Really, really funny. Like, he'll cackle at it. I think mainly because... So Sho goes in, he's angry because his mum's thrown away all these bits and bobs from his drawer, like, you know, I don't know, an old bone and some gunpowder he's found, and, you know, the kind of thing a kid has in their drawer.
Yeah.
And, you know, she's thrown it all away, and he's really outraged and angry, and she turns around and she's got a kitchen knife in her hand, and he's got this great shot, the knife pointed at Sho, and he says, oh, are you going to stab me?
Yeah.
And the expressions in the Drifting Classroom are incredible because they're very much all or nothing. And most of the time, the kids react to everything with this sort of mouth agog, wide-eyed, gaping expression with lots of angry vibration lines around their heads. So it's like they're in constant states of shock or anger.
But on this occasion, the adult is not going to stab the child, but that is the anomaly.
Yes, on this rare occasion, that is not Sho's mother's plan. But Sho is so outraged, he then pulls the tablecloth off and, like, throws all the, you know, breakfast cutlery and implements onto the floor. And what George finds really funny here, which I hadn't really even picked up on before, is that Sho's mother seems to only be angry about one very plain looking bowl that ends up cracking the floor. Which is a good observation, because he has just wrecked the whole table, and then the next time he's like crouching over this very boring bowl really angry. So I guess it was her favourite bowl.
Yeah.
Anyway, she speaks harsh words, which she will soon regret.
Yes. We should probably clarify that this is not for children.
Well, I mean, it is. I mean, my 9-year-old stepson loves this manga, Ren.
Okay.
Okay, so it was originally intended for, it's a boys' manga. So it was originally intended for, I guess, older children, maybe younger teenagers.
Okay. It's not what we would generally in the UK consider suitable for children.
Okay, I think that's fair. this manga definitely really highlights a difference in terms of, I think, the media that might be considered suitable for children in Japan and the media that would be considered suitable for children in the UK.
Take your Japanese and show it.
Sure.
I would make a fairly strong case for it being okay for slightly older children.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is very violent. It's got a very cartoony style. Like, I wouldn't quite say that Umezu can draw, but he has his strengths and his weaknesses, basically. He's good at very detailed backgrounds. The architecture of the school was all really convincing. He's great at monsters. His human anatomy tends to leave something to be desired. his characters can be a bit off model, and they're always weirdly stiff. They look kind of like action heroes. Like they don't really have any flexibility. Like, they're never going to bend. Okay, like when they fall over, they kind of look like a domino being pushed over.
They're just like...
Yeah. So they don't quite look like real people. They are very figurative. So it is cartoony, which I think does create a disaster. I mean, when I sort of questioned with George... I mean, George sort of... I was reading it, and George sort of showed him the argument with Sho's mother, and I sort of then put it back, and he sort of then picked it up, you know, of his own volition, and I was like, I don't know, George, but he was really into it, and I was like, oh, right, I guess it was originally intended for boys your age, sure. And, you know, it's interesting, because he certainly doesn't cope with things that are obviously coded as horror. So I had another Umezu collection from the library, which was like creepy stuff. It was like Umezu's creepy book or something like that. And just like, oh, no, you know, not going to read that, it says it's creepy. He makes it literal and buy the book in that way. But I think he read The Drifting Classroom as an adventure story, basically.
Yeah.
A very violent adventure story. But when I said to George, oh, it's a bit violent, he said, well, I have seen Patrick from SpongeBob fall off a really high building and explode or something like that. I guess that's true. And so he gave me a couple of violent examples from SpongeBob to reassure me. And in a way, this is no less cartoony. You know, they're human characters, but this is clearly taking place within a very fantastical realm. And I think what Umezu is very good at is kind of seeing things from a child's perspective or getting inside that kind of all or nothing mindset you have as a child. There's a good series of articles on The Drifting Classroom on the Hooded Utilitarian blog, which we can link to in the notes. A few years old now, but they stand up really well. And one of them is talking about how adults are drawn in The Drifting Classroom, and that the men are always like barrel chested. You know,
they're hulking.
They're really big. But that is how a small child looking up an adult will see an adult, right? From a small child's perspective, adults are really big. And I think it is really committed to a kind of child's understanding and vision of the world. And the way that the children appraise themselves and see the adult world strikes me as quite accurate, that, you know, the kids do kind of have their own society and they kind of get on with things and they have, you know, lots of, say quibbles would be a bit too light in The Drifting Classroom, since, you know, they're trying to kill each other, but, you know, they don't always get along, but they also kind of see the adult world as a bit strange and incomprehensible and kind of ridiculous. You know, they have to kind of respect and obey adults, and sometimes they do see them as parental figures, but they also you know, I don't know, you know, they don't have so many illusions about the adult world, I would say.
What happened to my big game, Taggart? Where did it go?
Don't ever lose hope, Mark. It's all we've got.
Hope? In this situation? What kind of hope can we have here, Taggart? Do you still have hope?
So yeah, I don't know. I do think he gets children. So in some ways,
I mean, yeah. I think it does have, it has that kind of, that perspective in children's horror of, you know, you have the character who you relate to and who is coping with the situation.
Yeah.
And so you can cope. As long as Sho is coping, you can cope.
I think that's very true. And Sho is so infinitely, amazingly resourceful.
Yes.
And you know, it wouldn't have seemed like this in, you know, 72 or 74, but it's very video game-like in many regards. In terms of its plotting, the way that it's so obstacle-oriented, and it is one obstacle after another. And, you know, George has grown up, obviously, playing Minecraft, and he's generally that kind of kid anyway. You know, he's good at doing things with his hands, and, you know, he likes to know how to do things, and he had been going to this sort of weekly sort of on a school day for neurodivergent kids, this outdoor school basically once a week, where he'd be building fires and riding horses and things like that, and he's very good at this kind of thing. So I think it makes sense to me that the drifting classroom would appeal to him, because the kids, you know, are very hands-on and get on with stuff, and it's very kind of engineering and solution-focused.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they're confronted with problems, and Sho will generally come up with a way to battle that problem, and some lives will be lost, but they'll move on to the next thing.
Yeah. And I think, thinking about it, this is probably partly why I found the bit with where Sho has his appendix removed, the most disturbing part. Is that, I mean, apart from the horror of someone being operated on without anaesthetic, which is obviously pretty horrifying, but also it's the one part where Sho is not in control.
Yeah,
he's out of commission.
Yes, yeah, that's very true. And being operated on by an untrained child, of course.
yes, by a child.
So yeah, I don't know, because we can't really, I say there's so much in terms of the plot.
I think should we talk about how quickly the adults go off the rails?
Yes, so what adults do we have? It's basically all teachers, isn't it?
Yeah. And obviously Sakia, who isn't a teacher, he's a delivery man and has a massive chip on his shoulder about this, we're led to believe.
Yeah, which is sort of tragic, because the kids at first love him, and, you know, they've all called him like the lunchroom guy, and it turns out he's like, I hated that, you kids calling me that lunchroom guy.
So Sakia is our human villain, the adult who survives the longest and causes the most trouble. Initially, we have the faculty of teachers, and kind of as soon as the school realizes that they've initially they think the whole world beyond the school has been obliterated.
Yeah, I think they assume it's been a nuclear war or something.
And so sort of the teachers notice, and then the kids sort of rush out to the gate, and a teacher called Mr. Wakahara blocks their exit. So there's a kind of panicked rush, and then a teacher called Mr. Awakara grabs his own son.
Well, you don't even know this at first, right? This is
you don't know it's his own son.
Yeah, the fact that it's his own son is his explanation for why he does it, why yeah. it's acceptable.
Yeah, okay, so he just grabs a child, takes off his own glasses, smashes the glass, and stabs this child in the arm with the broken glass. So, and then he's holding a child who's gushing blood onto the playground with a bloody weapon in his hand, shouting, "Now would you please calm down?" Which, I mean, what's more likely to calm a group of yeah,
it's in every teacher training book I've ever come across.
Yeah. and then this is revealed to be his own son, which makes it better? Question mark.
So yeah, the teachers don't cope so well.
Yeah. And it's pretty soon that Sekiya starts saying that he's going to hoard all the food for himself, and then sets the teachers on fire, who are around the lunchroom trying to reason with him. But at this point, Sho is like, "I think we're going to have to look after ourselves."
And the kids and do quite well temporarily restraining Sekiya, don't they?
Yeah, they tie him up and put him in a locker. Which works for a little while before he manages to gain a child's sympathy and trick him into letting him out. Meanwhile, Mr. Wakahara gets in a murderous rage and kills all of the remaining teachers.
He gives them fair warning, though.
Yeah, he does go, "Tie me up, I'm having a turn," kind of thing. And they're like, "What?"
Yeah, and then the guy starts tying him up and he's like, "It's too late." he's like, "No, sorry, too slow, tying me up." Crystal Maze escape room failed, you know.
Mr. Wakahara kills all of the teachers apart from Sekiya and then tries to run down the students in a car.
Yeah, across the desert wastelands.
which is at this point when we get this first example of two of this brilliant plot device that I'm in love with, where Sho Nishi, who is a character, a girl who uses crutches, and so sort of Sho has to help her quite a bit when they're during various running away from perils and things. But it turns out that it's kind of through Nishi that Sho can talk to his mother the past.
And I think, you know, there are some I guess outmoded gender dynamics here. Sho is generally the one to rescue Nishi, and she is very much coded in terms of her disability. But there is a kick-ass moment where she hurls her crutch through the windscreen of the teacher's car.
Yes.
She's given a whole, I don't know if it's a whole splash page or just half a page, she's given a really big panel of the crutch going through the windscreen, the glass shattering, it looks great.
Yeah, yeah. This is before safety glass, you know. It's just big shards.
Yeah.
Sho and Nishi has kind of escaped to this sort of... All the buildings are sort of bombed out, but they're kind of crawling through tunnels, and they end up in, like, looking out over, like, the wasteland from what used to be a high up window in a tall building. Mr. Wakahara's behind them, about to kill them.
Bearing down on them. Yeah.
And then Sho's like, "Right, I need to
I need my mother's help, right? And he kind of, through Nishi, somehow he manages to communicate with his mother in the past. And he manages to communicate where he is and that he needs a knife. So then we get this great, like, break to the past and show's mother and, you know, everyone thinks she's mad.
But she's not, she's just incredible.
Yeah, she's just amazing.
Show's mother's easily my favourite character in the whole movie.
You're so great. And she's like, no, Show needs my help! And, like, finds this building, you know, it's kind of drawn to this building, breaks into this hotel.
And she takes one of Show's, like, 10-year-old or 12-year-old friends with
her. Oh, yeah. She takes, what's his name? Shinchi. She takes Shinchi with her. they kind of disturb this couple, like, in Fugante, kind of in this hotel room.
Get out of this room!
My son needs my help! and the security, you know, staff, like, to kind of restrain her and bundle her out. But then she, like, goes back in a disguise the next day and books the hotel room for herself. And then she's like, Shinchi, distract them. I need to drill a hole in this wall and, like, make sure no one calls security. She, like, gets out her drill and, like, embeds this knife in this wall so that in the future, the wall's crumbling apart and he manages to grab this knife and, like, stab Mr. Wakahara, who falls to his death. Which is amazing.
And it's not even the most outlandish of Show's mother's plans by a long way.
It's not! The next one is even better. Shall we just go on to
that? Yeah, because it's amazing.
It's so good. Okay, so...
I don't even know how to describe the next plan.
So one of the terrible obstacles that they have to overcome is that there's an outbreak of the Black Death among the student population.
Yeah, if you thought it was bad that they didn't have any food or water, or that there are monsters around, the Black Death comes back.
Yeah. So there's a student called Hashimoto who gets these black spots on his leg, and there's the doctor's kid who later does the... Ependectomy, who's like, oh, I think he's got the plague. And so all the Show and all the kids who have been near Hashimoto are forced out of the school. pursued by kids who want to murder them. So they run into the desert and they think that they also are infected and that they're going to die. So Show says, okay, we should find the old hospital. Because they might, you know, they've managed to look it up, I think, and they found, you know, what the antibiotic is that cures the Black Death, and they're like, right, we should go to the hospital and see if they have it. And the hospital's mostly just a big hole in the ground, but they find a basement which has a mummy in it.
Yeah, a real life mummy.
A real mummy
that sits up like in the movies.
But it's the only sheltered spot for anywhere, so they spend the night, they turf the mummy out and spend the night in this sort of basement bunker, and wake up without any fever or any black spots, so they're all right. But it turns out that there were other kids who were looking after Hashimoto as he was sick, and they have been infected by the Black Death. So Show shouts to his mother again through Nishi, and we need medicine, we need this this particular antibiotic.
And so a plan is
mummy.
Born.
right.
And the mummy has a scar on its arm.
Yeah, the mummy has a scar on his right wrist, okay?
So it shouldn't right? be, it should be hard mum. To find.
So Show's mother goes on this, like, epic quest. You know, she goes to the hospital to try and find these antibiotics. She sees a man with a scar on his wrist. She's like, right, that guy's going to be the mummy. he turns out to be a famous baseball player. They go to the baseball game. He gets like concussed by a baseball.
Yeah, after Sho's mum invades the pitch.
And yeah, Sho's mum invades the pitch,
which I think is worth noting because it gives rise to the most unreasonable murderous mob in the whole of the Drifting Classroom, because there's a lot of murderous mobs in the Drifting Classroom of adults and of children. But normally this is because, you know, they're dying of the Black Death or they're starving or what. This case, it's just that this baseball player managed to make the play. And they're so angry at this, they're all trying to kill Sho's mother.
And maybe this is an indication of how far society is already degraded. He gets concussed. Sho's mother goes back to the hospital. And the staff are like, oh, yes, he's in a coma. And she's like, oh, okay.
Interesting.
She invades his room and it turns out he's not in a coma. He just doesn't want to play baseball anymore.
there's a great Goosebumps style, it was a monster. Oh, no, it was my dog in a mask moment where his silhouette appears with this baseball bat. And she's like, oh, yeah. And she's like, are you going to kill me? And he's like, what? No. Well, look, why are you invading my room? I'm a baseball player. I was just practicing my swing.
I've forgotten how this is.
Okay, there's a random robber apropos of nothing.
He
attacks a child, and then he heroically, because it's so heroic that he's mummified.
He saves the child and it's so heroic that they're like, yes, we will mummify.
Yeah, the Japanese government is like, right, better turn him into a mummy.
As you do. And so she's like, right, great. And sneaks into the basement, cuts open his stomach, sneaks in the antibiotics, sews him back up. Sho.
Bada bim, bada boom. Yeah.
Cuts open the mummy's stomach. Medicine. Everyone's cured. Brilliant.
It's also what makes it hard to do a claim of the week this week, because kind of the whole Drifting Classroom is one long claim or series of claims. And more to the point, pretty much anything Sho's mum says could be taken as a claim of the week, except for the fact that they turn out to be right.
Yeah. I also love that there was like a fake out of this happening for a third time. And later on when they're in the old subway station and it's being flooded and like, and Sho's like, oh, right, okay, I'll just call my mum and get her to not build a pipe here. And I'm like, all right, okay, what's she going to do this time? And then it's like, oh no, it didn't work. Nishi isn't here.
But yeah, this sort of theme of a mother's love being eternal is really important in the Drifting Classroom. Mm-hmm. And I think lends to the sentimentality of the film, which we'll go on to discuss shortly. But yeah, it's interesting. Like, I did a paper, partly why I wanted to do the Drifting Classroom is I did a sort of academic paper on it recently, and I did a sort of psychoanalysis of it. So, but instead of inspired by Sigmund Freud, it was inspired by Melanie Klein, mostly because I prefer her. I find her ideas more interesting. And the difference between Freud and Melanie Klein was that Melanie Klein did her therapy with very young children. And Klein has this idea of the good breast, bad breast, right? And the idea is that a very young child, an infant, they don't really understand their mother as a human being, that just as this sort of provider. And when the mother has milk to give, they see the mother as good breast and all is well with the world. And then when the mother isn't present, the mother's absent or doesn't have milk, then that is bad breast and everything's awful. And it's this sort of switch between, you know, so she's sort of thinking about why, you know, babies are either, you know, gurgling with happy excitement or screaming as though the worst thing in the world's happened. And so, you know, it is this very binarized view of things being fine or things being terrible. And it's exactly this kind of logic that defines the drifting classroom. That either everything is celebratory and the mother is present and she can solve everything magically, or everything is devastation and the world is over. And there's very kind of infantile logic and like response to anxiety. And I was arguing, this maps on really interestingly and neatly to how people, in our society at least, tend to respond to the threat of ecological devastation, climate change. So that on one side, you either have the deniers and the delayers who say, no, it's not that bad, or geoengineering will probably sort it out, or Elon Musk knows what he's doing. You know, or it's a conspiracy, or, well, we just need to take incremental steps and put some policies in place in carbon taxing. Or, on the other side, the doomer position of, well, it's too late, you know, our fate is sealed, there's no point doing anything, near-term human extinction, you know, we're all going to be gone within 15 years anyway. And both ways are ways of not staying with the trouble, to use Donna Haraway's phrase, like, both kind of resolve the anxiety by collapsing it into certainty. Either everything is fine or everything is already ruined. It's like, and it's like it's not dealing with the slow decline, it's not dealing with the suffering, it's not dealing with adaptation measures or the injustices, etc. You know, it immediately is everything's over, humanity's extinct. Like, it kind of disavows the journey. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't accept the process.
Yeah.
Because even if that is the case, it's not going to happen overnight. And that's hard. That's hard to sit with. That's scary. And so a way of dealing with that kind of fear is to kind of not think about it. Is to kind of, you know, throw up your hand and say either, oh, there's no issue and it'll be magically solved, or no, it's too late and there's nothing I can do about it and nothing governments can do about it. And I think the drifting classroom kind of is quite similar in that logic for the most part, although the ending of it ultimately, I think, does say that we should try to stay with the trouble and be adaptive.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, well, that, it is sure growing up at the end. Is his journey of growing up, and
I think leaving behind, you know, he accepts that he can't go home again. Ultimately, so does not return to the past. He does not return to his mother. What he does is makes the best of it. He accepts on some level that the earth is in a state of ruination, but he's still there. You know, and the kids are still there, and so they try to live as long as they can live, basically. I guess, yeah, because it does strike me that the whole of the drifting classroom is kind of about anxiety and responding to anxiety and fear. And Sho kind of learns to do this over the course of the... Because if you compare him to... So can you remember the name... of the other child leader, or there are two other self.
Ultimo.
Yes, so there are two other self-appointed leaders. There's a princess or queen, and Ultimo, and he's very different to Sho because he, in some ways, is more harshly pragmatist, but he's just far more pessimistic and far more willing to resort to violence, basically. You know, so Sho will say, no, we've got to keep going. We can find a way to save these other kids. Whereas he'll say, no, give up on them. Or no, we should just kill them before they infect other people. Like, that tends to be the split between them. And Umezu's definitely on side of Sho. You know, there's no mistaking that Sho is our hero here. The Ultimo becomes Mark in the film. Who is perhaps a more significant character and a more annoying one. So the film, so for some context, okay, the film was made with kids from a transnational military school, basically, you know, so a school where military brats go. So some of the kids are Japanese, some are American. They are generally speaking English, although sometimes this is subtitled on screen. And then there are some lines in Japanese.
See you later, my teacher.
So, here's the plan. Let's scrape the 57 million this weekend.
Nah, this weekend's out.
Again? No, he isn't. Isn't it? Mommy.
Whoa, look who's talking. You're calling Dad, Daddy.
Look, Mark and his daddy.
You have a nice day, Mark.
Okay.
Don't wake you up again.
Bye.
It seems like the way kids were recruited for this film was a bit ad hoc. So I read this interview with the guy who played Kenny, who's the one black child in the class. And he says literally the way he was recruited into the film was he was walking to school and a man in a car slowed down next to him and said, "Hey, kid, you want to be in a film?" Yeah. And thank heavens, he actually was a film producer.
What are the odds?
Yeah. But clearly they struggled getting bilingual kids for this film because they're of very varying ages. So they're all, I guess this sort of makes sense because the school, like the kids of the dripping class, you know, it seems to go anywhere from sort of earliest primary school through to, I guess, middle school. You know, the oldest probably around to 12, 13, and the youngest to like 5. However, the guy playing Mark looks like he's a good 10 years older than the rest of them. Which would be okay if it weren't for the fact that he seems to have a sort of romance with one of the other kids. Who looks a lot younger than him.
Ayumi!
Mark! Hey, Mark, wipe them out at soccer match next Sunday.
Right. You gonna come and cheer us on again?
Of course I'll be there.
If I win again, don't I deserve a kiss? All right, this is gonna be my big game.
That was awesome.
So I think we're inclined not to like Mark very much from the start because he seemed like a complete creep, which may not so much be the performer's fault or the character's fault as the casting director's fault.
Yeah.
But he's also the only one who's kind of coded as sort of wholesomely all-American.
Mm-hmm.
So he's a football soccer champ, which he... he likes to remind us, as viewers, at any given opportunity. No matter how bad the situation gets, the true tragedy is that it was going to be Mark's big game.
My big game is gone. Everything's buried deep in the sand.
Well,
it was his big game. And if it weren't for the fact that he's been teleported thousands of years into the future, he would have got to have played his big game. But alas... Yeah. there's a lot of Mark being very mopey and self-indulgently moping about not being able to play football.
Yeah.
And an amazing shot where he kicks a football into space.
Do you want to hear my drifting classroom notes that are not going to illuminate anything about the film whatsoever?
So these are the notes you took while watching the film?
These are the notes I took while watching the film. This is the sum total.
Okay, sure, yeah.
Okay. Right. Here comes the bride interlude. Oh yeah, a time slip. Green wobbly legged creature. I hate sand. Trombones and musical medley. Bloody skeleton effect.
Watch out! It's fixed! It's time magic!
Crab creatures. Finally, you will be king, Mark. Gooey xenomorph horseshoe crabs. Children go to the future. They always do. I hope to have your baby someday soon.
I want to have your baby soon. Someday soon.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that sums up the film pretty well.
Yeah.
To be fair, so it may seem like a counterintuitive choice on the surface to turn what is a rather bloody horror adventure manga into a sentimental comedy romance musical. Filmed entirely inside an aircraft hangar filled up with sand.
Mm.
And that would be true. I can't argue against that. But I really like the damn thing. I don't really know why. It's a pretty shoddy production, I think it's fair to say. So yeah, you're not going to disagree with that. like with the far superior House or House Sue, it has a lot of matte painted backdrops, which I tend to be a bit of a sucker for. So a lot of, you know, pretend fake painted backgrounds. They're really obviously fake here. Like, very obviously, I say the whole film was apparently made inside an aircraft hangar filled up with sand.
Yeah, I mean, the blue screen is wavering around the characters.
Yeah.
Outlines for the whole film.
Yeah, you have to get used to that. And it must have been a horrible production in many regards. I mean, the guy who played Kenny said it was quite fun, but, I mean, the film's sponsored by McDonald's. And fair play. I think it's quite gutsy of McDonald's to want sponsorship for a vision of a post-apocalyptically environmentally blasted Earth. You know, at least that's sticking to their own vision for the future. And you do get a McDonald's sign at some point in the film. But
it's like, you know, Coca-Cola sponsorship in the road, isn't it?
Oh god! Oh yeah, yeah. It's quite like that actually. but so apparently, the only thing the kids were fed, like the whole catering budget, was McDonald's. So this was the sponsorship deal. You know, they do some product placement for Mackey D's, and they fed the whole crew and cast on McDonald's.
Right.
So if you imagine a closed set, an aircraft hangar, full up with sand and hundreds of McDonald's burgers.
Oh.
Like, the smell must have been wretched. Like, that alone is a vision of hell, freaking hell.
Right, yeah.
So it's, you can feel like maybe not everyone's on the same page with the production. We have one semi-famous actor with Troy Donahue, playing the teacher character here. Stalwart of many B movies.
This is your Great Dane. You're telling me that's your dog?
He's really the kind of only name actor we've got here. And the kids vary a lot in terms of their acting ability, I'd say. Mm. Personally, I find that quite charming, because it gives the whole thing a kind of slightly naive earnestness that the kids do feel like real kids, and they're quite awkward, a lot of them, on camera. Yeah. Why they decided to make it a kind of halfway musical, I don't know. Because it only has two musical sections.
Yeah, well, there's Here Comes the Bride. bit.
Yeah, which isn't just them singing. What... They do a little dance and things at the same time.
Yeah.
Like they're,
yeah.
You know, you've got someone playing an instrument, playing the violin, and other kids like banging their hands on the table to create percussion.
Mm-hmm. And then there's a bit with the trombones. And
Yes, which is a whole kind of musical medley of different...
Yeah.
I mean, it's mostly that Camptown ladies sing this song, do-da, do-da.
Oh, yeah.
But then
there's other songs layered on top as well.
Yeah, other sort of Yankee Doodle songs. As I say, sort of over-layered, sung at different pitches and registers. And at different times as well. While they do kind of coordinated dances.
Yeah, kind of.
The rest of the music, however, is excellent. it's the same composer as Nausicaa.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, Miyazaki's early composer did the synth music here.
Nice.
Yeah. But I don't know. I mean, I kind of love it because it's weirdly kind of, I don't know, these kind of seem like characters from like Saved by the Bell or something. Like in a way, like they're clearly going for these sort of teen film archetypes, but then kind of pushed to their utmost limits. So, like, you know, Mark is, like, this sort of jock character, but then he's, like, only defined in those terms. You know, so he's, like, constantly shown with his football. and like, I guess I like the way that it doubles down a lot of aspects of the film. So, as I say, in the... I kind of... It's tricky, right? Because this isn't really an appropriate thing to make fun of, but it is also played comedically in the film. So I want to step kind of lightly around it. But, like, the show definitely has an intense mother fixation in the comic. The film starts with him getting out of a shower naked and, like, kind of grabbing his mother. Yeah. At the very least, harassing her.
Yeah. Yeah, it was surprising. I was taken aback by that.
Yeah, I don't... I don't know if it's just to kind of foreground the intensity of the mother-son relationship here. But everything, you know, like the violence certainly isn't dialed up. You know, clearly there is an attempt here to go for a family audience. But certain of the kind of emotional aspects are dialed up. It's much more overtly sentimental. than the manga is. So there are sort of heartfelt exchanges with Mark saying, like, you know, but I'm never going to be able to play my big game. And then, like, Troy Donahue being like, you've got to have hope, Mark. There's always hope. How can I have hope here, Taggart? And they've tried to introduce a kind of goofy mascot character in this green alien who isn't in the film, who isn't in the manga at all. I don't know if this was like meant to be the McDonald's toy tie-in promotional character. If it was, he'd have to have a little reservoir or container for water that if you squeezed him, he would pee. Because the main thing the alien does in the film is provide water for the kids, which is great and needed.
It's a little puppet thing.
Yeah, a little kind of cute puppet thing that wheezes a lot.
Yeah.
Basically. Yeah. And dances around.
Yeah.
He likes music. But it's quite important in the film because in the comic, basically, they spend a lot of time fighting these kind of crab creatures. And it turns out that these are just the descendants of humans.
Yeah.
So these are humans many, many thousands of years in the future. And actually, hey, can't they just get along? And they do. I don't really get how they do in the comic. Do they just sort of, you know, put their differences aside?
I can't... I am... The... the crab mutants just end up, I don't know if they're eaten or they just run into the mouth of a giant worm. I don't think it's actually clear what their relationship is to the giant worm.
Okay.
But,
So this is the rare example of some better plotting in the film than in the manga.
Yeah, yeah, I think, yeah.
So in the film, the alien turns out to be like the kind of infant version of one of these crab aliens, and it goes off happily to meet the other crabs, and basically, I guess, bears good news. Hey, these kids are all right. and so we have a nice scene of Sho and possibly Nishi being kind of embraced in a nice big bear hug by one of these these crab creatures.
Yeah.
And then...
Yeah, we have...
Sorry.
No. No, carry on.
No, you carry on.
Okay. We haven't mentioned the whole part of the manga where it turns into the fly.
What? The body horror stuff?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess I hadn't mentioned it because I don't even understand it. Like, I can't. Is it just through sheer force of will that some of the kids start transforming themselves into kind of hybrid?
No, they eat the mushrooms.
Oh, it's the mushrooms, isn't it? Sorry, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
They eat the mutant mushrooms that start sprouting up in the school garden. And then they start transforming into the mutant crab creatures. But before they get there, like in The Fly, there is a moment where they feel euphoric and superpowered and such.
Yeah, and they're sort of walking around on all fours. But anyway, crab creatures and children, human children, do make peace. And in the film, and we're left with this sort of bizarre utopic vision of the kids all wearing. I mean, they suddenly look like they've started a cult.
Mm.
Like they're all wearing, like, I don't even know what it is. If it's like, I thought it was sackcloth, but it's like kind of white. It looks like they've made themselves robes. And this is where you get the line that you mentioned at the end.
Children go to the future, they always do.
No, I was thinking of the Nishi substitute character saying, someday I want to have your baby soon to Sho.
Yes, yes.
And Sho looks very proud.
He
makes a very, I'm the man expression. I don't know, I think that might be the last line in the film.
Yeah, I think it is.
So, I guess the kids will be all right. I suppose they've started their future civilization.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's... From what I'm saying... I mean, okay, in some regards, it is a disquieting film. You know, there are quite troubling elements to this film. I think this is undercut by the kind of... odd amateurishness and the sentimentality, possibly. Because, like, describing it, I feel it should trouble me and weird me out more than it does. And, you know, I think it's partly cultural differences, but I think it's also, it reassured me, right, reading this great... I'll try to send you the link to it, but this interview with... the guy who played Kenny, and he's talking about it, and he said it was a fun film to make, and that all the kids had a good time, and, you know, fond memories. So that's good to read. That it's not like it was some horrible exploitative or degrading process to make this film. It is. I don't know. It is a bit squicky. But, like, it's also so weird. It's really hard to get a handle on.
Like,
because the manga's already very odd, but it knows what it's doing. Umezu clearly is a man of curious ideas.
Yes.
You know, so there's some wild stuff in the manga, but it's very of a piece, right? It feels coherent.
Yeah.
You know, it's of a piece with itself. The film is not like that at all. The film is one of the messiest things I think I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Which is kind of why I love it, because it's so chaotic. And it's always fun when you watch a film like that, thinking, what on earth were the creative decisions behind this?
Mm-hmm.
It certainly doesn't work as a straight adaptation of the manga in the slightest. So if you look at the YouTube comments, you tend to get a lot of very angry comments from fans of the manga. But I kind of feel like that's people taking the manga too seriously, because the manga's ridiculous in the first place.
Yeah. I mean, at the end, the Sakia is actually killed by like the half face and arm of a burglar, where half his arm, and half of his face are in the future, and the rest of his body is in the past. And he managed to propel his arm and half face, with a knife into the air to kill the villain. So
it's high concept.
Yeah.
And while I wouldn't recommend that you go straight from reading The Drifting Classroom to 14, a later Umezu manga, if you want to see Umezu double down on his high concept ideas, that's the place to go. So 14 is much more for an adult audience. It's more explicit than Drifting Classroom, and more disturbing, and I think deliberately disturbing. It's similarly apocalyptic. The basic plot of it, which I won't really be able to recount in any sensible amount of time, but is that genetically modified synthetic chicken meat comes to life, it's like putting the plasma pool, comes to life, becomes this creature called Chicken George, which is the embodiment of all animal consciousness. Chicken George has a kind of second-in-command best friend called Chicken Lucy, who is actually a chicken. Chicken George, meanwhile, is a kind of human-chicken hybrid man who wears a lab coat.
Right.
Meanwhile, the world is ending. Things have happened like there's no green trees or greenery anywhere anymore. And no one seems to have noticed until, like, the president of America is like, "Oh no, we're gonna run out of oxygen pretty soon. We better trick everyone so they don't panic by making pretend leaves out of foil and putting them on all the trees around the world overnight." There are a lot of plans in this comic, but basically, lots of terrible things happen, and Chicken George decides to create his own Noah's Ark. In order to rescue all the other animals which have been so badly treated by humans, who he's going to, you know, leave on the cursed planet. Okay, so Chicken George's logical explanation for why humans are as terrible as we are is because, and he does a, you know, totally scientific, like, DNA test to determine this, humans evolved from the Tyrannosaurus Rex. And the Tyrannosaurus Rex is the most evil and terrible of all the dinosaurs.
Okay.
However, despite this, he chooses, ironically, to make his spaceship Ark in the form of a giant Tyrannosaurus Rex. Which seems like the last design he'd choose. But anyway, he fills that up with some animals, and then some children do get aboard it. They kind of end up making friends with Chicken George, and then they cross into a parallel dimension where it's mostly chicken people, and they find out that the whole universe in which the Earth was contained was actually just an insect. It was like a bug.
Right.
And that's sort of the end.
Okay.
If that sounds incomprehensible, it is much more incomprehensible to read it. Like, that's me wrestling with some effort, some sense out of what happens in 14.
Oh, yeah, thank you for your hard work.
Yeah. So yeah, if you've listened to this podcast and thought, well, I don't know, the Drifting Classroom seems a bit tame, to be honest. It sounds like not very much happens in it, and it's maybe a bit too down to earth for me, a bit too kind of slice of life, too kitchen sink. Then I would read 14.
Sorry, I just need to go to the loo.
Should we finish off? Because we've reached an hour.
Oh, okay. We need to do Texture of the Week.
Oh my God, we haven't done Texture of the Week. Disastrous. I don't even have any. I'll make some noise. Of the week.
Of the week.
Yeah, gosh. There's a lot. There's a lot of text. I mean, I really love the kind of squamous, gelatinous textures of the kind of protoplasmic alien beings. There's a shot of the desert landscape, all of these kind of writhing, kind of ditto-like creatures. Yeah. Which is amazing. Like, that panel is incredible. So that would be kind of my outright texture, I suppose. But also, similarly gelatinous, the textures of the tears.
Oh.
So whenever the children cry in this, their tears look like jelly. Like, they are, in keeping with the kind of aesthetic of the Drifting Classroom, is it's all or nothing, and they don't just cry, they bawl, and you know, their whole face streams with these giant gelatinous tears.
Nice. My one, which I don't, it's quite close to the beginning, but I saw it and I was like, I love this, was quite early on, after the teachers have been massacred and the first sort of batch of students have died in various ways, like some of them fall off the roof and such. But they bury their dead, and because they don't have any incense to burn on the grave mounds, so they take cigarettes from the staff room and burn the cigarettes on the grave mounds.
Oh yeah,
and I just love that image. Yeah.
Oh. Well, yeah, so I don't know if... I mean, would you recommend The Drifting Classroom?
I'd recommend the manga. I'm not wholly sold on the film.
That's fair. But you would recommend the manga?
Yeah, I mean, it's a rump and a half.
Yeah.
We haven't even touched on most of the plot.
Oh, I know. God, like,
there's just not enough time.
I know, there's way... you'd have to do, like, 10 episodes, to be honest. Like, yeah. You know, there's so much malarkey, so much chaos. Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't really recommend it to kids, although that's very hypocritical of me since I've been letting my 9-year-old stepson read it. it is very violent. It is also ridiculous and cartoony. So, like... I don't know. I think it would really depend on the child as to whether they'd find this disturbing or not.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have coped with it as a kid. I don't think. Yeah. But... I don't know. Like... I think if you're listening to this and you're like a survivalist and you and your kids live out in a cabin or something and regularly go hunting, then they'll love this.
Yeah.
I feel like,
you know, it's black and white, yeah, which helps.
Yeah, that's true, actually.
The graphic blood.
I think it does. That does help. Because it's weird. Okay, I'd more readily recommend the manga to kids than I would the film, even though the film is ostensibly more child friendly. The film is clearly aimed at this sort of family audience, but I find the film kind of more troubling than the manga.
Yeah.
for what it's worth. But yeah, it's a wild read, and I've certainly not read anything quite like it apart from Umezu's other manga. Like,
I enjoyed it. I got increasingly into it. Aghast at like what new plot could happen next.
Yeah.
Twist.
Yeah, yeah.
Is going to be served up next.
I think when I look back upon my life at the end of it, I'll think, I'm glad I read the dream. I'm glad that was part of my experiences. it's not a manga that's easily forgotten.
Yeah. Cool.
Hey.
Hmm.
Well, thank you for reading it, and we'll probably do something really low key next time.
I enjoyed it, and it was different.
Yeah,
what we're doing recently.
That's true.
Thank you for listening. You can find us on Twitter at Still Scared Pod, or email us at stillscaredpodcast@gmail.com. Our intro music is by Maki Yamazaki, who was also my Japanese name pronunciation consultant, although mistakes are all my own. Outro music's by Joe Kelly, artwork's by Letty Wilson. I think that's it. Do you have a sign up for us?
Yeah, I do. Always have hope, creepy kids. Hope's all we've got.
See you next time, creepy kids.
Bye.
Bye.